Hello. We recorded this episode of Table Talk a little earlier in the year, before the current situation with COVID-19 had arisen. So if you hear conversation about restaurants and dinner parties with no mention of social distancing or isolation, that's why. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are joined by actor and Guardian columnist Rick Samada. His recent memoir, I Never Said I Loved You, is a profound, moving and seriously funny book that examines everything from drama school to the meaning of life via mental illness, kitchen gadgets and grief. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Rick, we'll start where we always start on this podcast. What was food like when you were younger?
Well, sweets were a lot of what I ate when I was younger. I used to have I had a very sweet tooth, I still do. At home, I remember a lot of freezer food in a way that sort of then fell out of fashion, but a lot of kind of crispy pancakes and I remember Chicago Town pizzas, microwavable pizzas were a real... In terms of home cooking, there were proper meals being cooked by my mum, but because she was cooking for my dad, who had health problems, they were quite restricted, so it would be a sort of alternation of chicken and fish. Sort of every night, chicken, fish, because he had to have quite restricted.
Yeah, it sounds from the book like he took his nutrition very seriously, and your mum did not take her personal nutrition as seriously as he did. Would that be fair?
Yes. Well, now she's just a very adventurous person at heart, and she was looking after someone who had to be, because of his health situation, more restricted and more careful. So she was having to be more careful and cooking these quite simple meals, you know, just rice, vegetables, and then fish or chicken. And so, sadly, he died about 10 years ago. And then since then, she's really exploded and really kind of embraced her natural adventurousness in the kitchen.
I mean, some of the descriptions of her, less her cooking and more her sort of meal coordination in the book are just my favourite passages. When you talk about the things that you will arrive at the dinner table all in one go.
Yes. I mean, when you go around for dinner and there's about 30 plates set out and just like... pizza, croissant, olives, and then there'll be like a bit of lamb here. There'll be some like Chinese dumplings here, some like M&S, those sort of picnic starter things here. And then she'll have made like a sort of big fish, and then there's every type of meat and fish. And in one meal, it's too much. We have to have a talk
like
about it recently.
Feast.
It is an amazing
feast. One of the things
feast.
Also mentioned in the book is venison, which you said was always in the fridge. Tell us why venison was always in the fridge.
Yes, and I don't want people to have the wrong idea, because this is Lewisham. And we're not of a kind of background, either culturally or financially, where you'd expect to have venison at the table. But this is sort of... just, again, she'd have these kind of... she'd develop these weird fixations, and so we'd have a lot of slices of venison in, like... vacuum-packed packets, always in the fridge every time I went around. And she didn't seem to eat a lot of it. It'd always be given to me.
Did you like it?
Not particularly. I mean, I preferred other things. I don't know why. But she sort of replaced that recently with crab pate. There's always crab pate, and it's either on a pizza or on a croissant or just a block of it will be given to me. She goes through phases. She's endlessly curious, and I love that about her.
I like the description of the tumble puddings
that
you describe that she makes in the book.
Yes, medley. So she'd get, say, a big bowl of custard and then some M&Ms. She'd throw them in there, and then maybe a tart, and she'd sort of chop it up and throw that in there, and then put a flake on top.
It's just very innovative.
I mean, if Heston was doing it, people would be falling over themselves. It's all about context, isn't it?
And what about school food? Did you like school food?
I don't remember it that much, which suggests it was quite bland. There's something about the smell of large batch cooking where you have to use, I guess, cheap ingredients as a matter of necessity that I think I don't like. I think I don't think it was hot bad, but... definitely the trip to sort of the newsagent to get sweets, possibly after a school dinner, would have been more the highlight of my day.
Not nostalgic for the semolina and Spam fritters.
No, I don't really have any strong memory of those. So, yes, not nostalgic at all for school dinners. Now, actually, in a weird way, I am more interested in the idea of like extremely convenient commodity packaged food. Like, I'm weirdly obsessed with airline meals, where you get everything in like a tray.
All in one.
Yes, all in one. We get like a rice situation here, and then like a mini poppadom chutney in like a tiny like thimble container.
Maybe you need those school trays that we used to have that, you know, have the space for your glass of squash and then you get your pudding on the stove. That's what you need at home.
I think I didn't appreciate them at the time. Now that I have to make my own food, it's like, if I want five elements here, I have to make five elements.
You are your mother's son, so of course you want 35.
And I do want, I want 50, but it's a lot of work. So having that all in one place is actually, I think I am nostalgic. I've just discovered in your question that
we've just tapped into it.
Yeah.
And you write in the book about at some point in your childhood, food became problematic for you. And you describe the boyhood anorexia that you had.
Mm.
You write quite extensively about the recovery from that. Would it be fair to say that now you have quite a good relationship with food? Or do you still struggle with some elements of it?
I do generally have a good relationship with food now, and I don't stop myself eating things that I want to. But it is always the first thing that will take a hit if I'm not doing so well. My diet will slightly degrade.
Yeah. The reason I ask is that you've described elsewhere at cooking as being a really important tool for your mental health. Mm. How did you find that? How did you find cooking, bearing in mind the problems that you'd had beforehand with food?
I guess learning to cook is a bit like learning to drive, which I didn't do. But I guess that sense of independence and freedom and self-sustainability, the ability to look after yourself, is so profoundly related to food. So I remember when I went to university, the realisation that if I didn't make a meal, and actually two or three meals a day, or, you know, maybe you'd have leftovers, but if I wasn't regularly feeding myself, I could die.
Yeah.
No one else was going to make me eat food. And so I was making a lot of mashed potato and sort of spaghetti and things, traditional student fare, because the kind of the shock of that burden of having to constantly be sustaining yourself and nourishing your body, it's like such a huge burden. But so that was difficult. It was a difficult kind of coming of age, and I think one that everyone has to go through. But then, so in my first relationship, I discovered sort of the joy of cooking, and I remember my partner teaching me how to kind of knock something up with whatever you've got, whether it's like a bean stew or just making a gremolata so you can zhuzh up some veg that you've got in the house, or, you know, just using what's there rather than it having to be a whole production. There's a resourcefulness and ingenuity to cooking, and then there's a joy of creation. If you want to go out and buy ingredients and follow a recipe, that's a sort of different, slightly more elaborate thing, but there's a real creativity in that, I think, and it's a way of expressing yourself. And yeah, just through her, I really discovered a love of what food could be. And yeah, to relate it to mental health, that simple thing of taking the steps you need to look after yourself. And if that's all you do in a day, that's a really huge achievement, and you've done right by yourself, and it is manageable.
And you seem, there's almost a kind of philosophical approach to food. There's one point in the book where you talk about comparing philosophers to vegetables, but then you also talk about, you say you like to bake and think about death. I mean, do you think food, do you sort of take quite a philosophical approach towards food, do you think?
I think it's not when I'm eating it, not most of the time. I mean, I just love eating. I'm quite gluttonous now, really. So no, but I do think it is interesting when you sort of step back from it. And, I mean, it is the sort of the basic block of staying alive is eating, is nutrition. That's our primary, apart from, you know, reproduction and shelter. That's what we need to do to stay alive. And that's sort of, so it's fundamental, but it's also now enshrined in culture as this mainstream thing. So it's become a very cultural product as well. And we can stake our identities around food and tell people who we are. And it's so connected to family and nation identity and, you know, all these other huge ideas. So I think it's completely fascinating on so many levels, food, as well as being just delicious and, a wonderful treat.
And there's a big difference between what you were describing in that first relationship, the sort of liberation of being able to make something interesting out of whatever's left over in the fridge, to baking, which is also something you have an interest in.
Yeah.
Where did the baking come from?
Baking, I started doing a lot of baking when I was doing this kitchen gadget column at The Guardian, because I was testing a lot of very often very silly gadgets that would try and make baking easier, because baking is quite, it's so technical, and actually it's sort of closer to chemistry a lot of the time, and it's all about timings and temperatures and process. And that wasn't really how I approached food before. I was very much just kind of slapdash, no fixed quantities, just whatever, if you like something, put more of it in. Mm. Realising that things would not work if you sort of went, not weapons-free, if you went free-wheeling. Off-script, that's a less aggressive editorial. Yeah, it's good to mix the registers. Yeah, so sort of having to be quite disciplined, but then the precision and the beauty of baking and, you know, biscuits and cakes and things, and they're as close to artwork and kind of sculpture a lot of the time as they are to just, you know, just a thing that you can eat or, you know, a treat. And I liked that kind of extra element of artistry involved in baking, and I responded to that a lot.
And tell us about the column. I mean, how did you come to be reviewing crazy gadgets for The Guardian?
Well, they wanted me to write. I was very lucky. They said, what are you good at? And I said, nothing. They said, what do you like? And I said, nothing. And they said, do you like to cook? And I went, oh, yes, I like to cook.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So my editor, Susan Smiley, the food and drink editor at the time, she really just gifted me this column. She sort of, I was so reluctant. I had no belief in myself. I would never pitch ideas. I'd never put myself forward for anything. But she really just walked me to the edge of it and said, we're going to do this. And if people hate it, we'll stop doing it in three or four weeks. But just try it, because I think it would be good.
And people loved it.
Yeah, and it had just the most extraordinary kind of response, which is remarkable because I didn't have a food background. I just had this kind of amateur enthusiasm. I loved playing and playing around in the kitchen. And I did it because they said they would pay for my groceries for the column. And I was like, oh, that sounds like quite a good deal in journalism. In an age where most of the good deals in journalism no longer exist, that seemed like a good one. So I took it, and it really changed my life.
And the sort of really, really big gadget that people still talk about now is, it produces a sort of egg roll. I'm not sure what the technical term for this gadget was, but it produces an egg on a stick, effectively.
Egg on a stick, like a sort of sulfuric lollipop of hellish design. Yes, I think it's called an Eggmaster, or a Rolly is another model. It's a vertical grill that you crack eggs into, and then it cooks inside this very sort of narrow cylinder. And then when it's cooked, the egg will spontaneously rise up out of the device, and it's quite horrific, and it stinks.
Are you meant to eat? I mean, are you meant to be encouraged to eat it with anything, or do you just eat it on its own?
I think you're meant to ward off the devil with it.
But in that way, I imagine it's quite effective.
Yes, or it invokes him. I don't know. It's something to do with that layer of hell, certainly.
And were there any gadgets that you still use in your kitchen? Were there any that, you know, took a place on your shelves?
Quite a lot of Joseph stuff is really nicely designed and ergonomically useful and compact. I've got quite a small kitchen, so anything that, even if it's like a can opener that's just a disc rather than sort of a long traditional can opener, that's quite useful to me because of how I arrange my kitchen. So that's quite good. But generally, no.
And that's why people love the column, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if something was rubbish, I would say it's rubbish about five times.
Is the Eggmaster, is that the worst thing you've tried, or is there something even more shocking?
I mean, they were all pretty bad, and that's the most grand guignol of the disasters, but there were all sorts of terrible... I mean, I remember one, like a mug... A mug for hot drinks, but there was a recessed cavity underneath the mug that could hold your biscuit and had this really scary face on the mug, which is, you know, for some reason. But also, when you went to drink from the cup, because the gap was at the front with the biscuit in, as soon as you held the cup to your face, the biscuit would fall out onto your lap.
Brilliant.
And if it was
design.
A chocolate biscuit, it would have melted because the heat from the cup, from the porcelain, had gone through. Absolutely rubbish.
And didn't you make Prosecco with a soda stream?
Yes, me and Felicity Cloak for a Christmas. Yeah, we had we did a Christmas dinner using kitchen gadgets. So we had three fountains: chocolate, cheese, and gravy.
Wow.
And then we made fake champagne.
Champagne, very nice.
So, yeah, with with this soda stream. It was I nearly electrocuted myself in the bath making that.
Did you put wine in and make it fizzy, or did
yes,
you
just put the cheapest
that's what champagne
one. Is. Yeah, that is what champagne is, I believe, having spoken to the farms of that region.
I mean, you say that if something was rubbish, you would say it was rubbish.
Mm.
There was at one point a restaurant review where you were not terribly flattering about the restaurant's produce, and you then went and worked a shift there, is that right?
Yes.
How was that?
Well, it was initially quite awkward and there are a lot of knives around, so I just thought it was, I mean, that I found that idea fascinating because now we live in a quite a confrontational culture and everyone has a lot of opinions, but there's also people that can respond to those, and so it is kind of becomes quite adversarial. And I'm interested in real life, in sort of cutting through that and sort of standing behind your opinions and meeting people and being like, yes, that's what I thought, but that's not all there is to me. We will have more in common than this one disagreement. And so actually I became really good friends with those people. And, you know, we still joke about the sort of the hostility, but actually it's, you know, their food is really great. As I did mention in the review.
It wasn't one-sided.
It wasn't completely one-sided. And I just think it's a really valuable thing for people to keep meeting in real life and understand that we're not all enemies, you know, in trenches all the time. We're just wandering around the same meadow, but maybe we've got a preference for different flowers.
You also have the wellness or hellness column in The Guardian. What do you make of the term wellness? It's one that obviously we hear a lot. In particular, what do you think of it in relation to food?
I think there can be quite a positive aspect to, I guess, well-being. I guess wellness is something different to well-being, maybe. It's more of an industry, but well-being is a good thing, and being mindful of what you eat is, I think, a key component of mental health and looking after yourself. So I think it's possible to have a focus on food and nutrition is really important. I think it does shade into kind of denial and kind of this whole thing of clean eating and fatty diets and magic ingredients that are going to sort of fix all your health concerns. And I think that's often quite cynical and quite harmful and just a lot of modern day snake oil. So there's a spectrum, really. I think there's a lot of good conversations that we had around well-being and food, but it often gets obscured by people trying to make a quick buck.
And when it comes to cooking for yourself at home, do you have a comfort food that you return to over and over again, or something new every time?
I've been trying to cook with a lot of meat substitutes, like a lot of people. I feel sort of hypocritical that I'm not a vegan, but I like eating meat. So I've been trying vegan alternatives. I keep a close eye on sort of things like that. So I'll make kind of vegan kebabs using pretend shawarma meat, or I'll do that ottolenghi tofu dish with all the mass amount of chili and what's that one? Do you know the one I mean?
It sounds good.
The black pepper.
The black pepper. Yes. Oh, that's powerfully good stuff.
That is really good.
yes, and for comfort food. What else? I mean, to be honest, at the moment, I feel like I should answer honestly. I've been going out a lot. I've been working late or going to events or things. So I don't have staples at home. So I had to cook for someone the other day and I didn't have garlic, which is sort of quite a key component for a lot of my cooking. And so when you've fallen out of the rhythm of cooking, you don't have the things at home, it becomes really difficult. So I've been eating really terribly. I've been eating sort of off-brand crisps that I've picked up from a newsagent or... gone back to mashed potato, kind of gone full circle.
It's
a good staple, yeah.
And tell us about the Bake Off, because obviously you also review that for The Guardian. Are you a huge fan of the Bake Off?
I'm not a huge fan, to be honest. I think I don't watch that much TV unless I have to write about it. I think it's wonderful that it's become such a success. It's such a British thing, this idea of like, it's quite a mild show about nice people helping each other.
In a tent.
Yeah, in a yurt with windows and mild, and puns are a big part of it. I think its spirit, its DNA is just a lovely thing. Maybe it's getting slightly more Americanized or just more... Everyone's on a very emotional journey, I've noticed recently.
Yeah, it's not quite as fluffy as it's it used not, to be, is it?
Yeah, and I sort of don't know how I feel about that. I don't always want to go on a big emotional journey and see someone realising their dreams or not. Something that's quite nice to just know how to make a tweel without burning it.
You say you still have a sweet tooth. How do you satisfy that sweet tooth as a grown-up?
Well, there's a Turkish shop near me and I often go there rather than the supermarket just because I don't know what any of the things in there are. So it's got that kind of magical sense of play that I used to enjoy about food. So I'll try new things, whether it's baklava or like they've got open baskets of sort of different candied fruits and things and different sweets. Or I try some, I'll try things, I'm quite adventurous, I'll try things I don't know what they are. Goes wrong quite a lot of the time. I bought the other day, I bought some, they're called banana rolls. They're quite a sort of malted, toasted flavour, like a biscuit tube, like a sort of cigarillo shape with a banana cream inside. It's very unusual. And I wouldn't say nice, but I'm glad I tried it. So yeah, odd foreign sweets, I think, are quite a fun way of teaching yourself as well as pretending you're not just stuffing your face with sweets, as you did as a child and are still doing in your late 30s. Yeah.
And who do you turn to when you want to know how to cook? I mean, are there certain writers that you love to read?
Well, for reading, I mean, Nigel Slater is just the granddaddy. I just love to his food writing is amazing. And Nigella also, that sense of gluttonousness, I just think is delicious. But for cooking, I use a lot of Anna Jones. I think she's got a really good tofu recipe in her Modern Way to Cook, which is, it's got soba noodles and red cabbage, and it's sort of really and marinated smoked tofu, which I hadn't had before. I tried the recipe, and it's just a really, so it is quite, and she's good on the whole well-being sort of eat clean because you want to and it tastes nice, but don't do it out of a sense of punishment. Like, you can have delicious food that's also good for you. And
so and it's all quite, her recipes work. That's yes. One of the brilliant things about her.
And they all feel quite hearty as well. Yeah. Don't they?
Yes,
they feel,
that's the
they
thing.
Feel like you're getting a proper meal rather than.
Well, she was Jamie Oliver's food developer for ages before she did her own. And I think she's just a brilliant recipe writer.
Yeah, you're so right. That's that sense of heartiness that I don't get from a lot of kind of healthy cooking.
No. There's a really good tomato cassoulet she does with coconut milk, which is just delicious. Yes. But it feels like you're getting a proper.
Yes, I'm working my way through her book, doing every single one is good. Yeah, and she's really unfussy about substitution. So she's got a whole chart of things you can actually throw in. So you don't, because I get a bit anal about recipes and I freak out if I don't have the za'atar or, you know, the pink peppercorns. And she'll say, no, just try this. Or she's really good at saying, just try this or throw this in. Or it's about texture as much as it is about flavour. Or here's some things that will do just as well. And here are dairy-free alternatives, whatever. So I think that freedom is quite empowering.
Yeah, liberating.
Yeah. She's great.
Rick, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. Rick's book, I Never Said I Loved You, is available in all good bookshops and online now. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.